European countries that send the most workers abroad. This brain drain costs Italy an estimated 14 billion euros every year.
It's an inconceivable waste. Once trained through our school system, our younger talents offer their skills to foreign countries. It's true, our labor market is stagnant, but it must be said that quite often the system does not reward merit.
Successive Italian governments had long tried attracting back talented workers with tax breaks, with no success. However, a counter-exodus of the brain drain seems to be underway since the start of the pandemic. Data from Italy's foreign ministry shows that in 2020 the number of young Italians returning home increased about 20% over the previous year. Max Civili, Rome.
A London-based Islamic Human Rights Commission made a plea with Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari, reminding the illegal grounds on which top cleric Sheikh Zazaki and his wife were being kept in prison. Simultaneously, the Islamic Human Rights Commission has also written to the United Nations asking the international body to exert pressure on Nigeria to do the same. Lawyer to the leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki, has expressed shock that 7 days after testing positive to COVID-19, Zazaki's wife, Zinat, is yet to be hospitalized. Also in a press conference, the Islamic movement in Nigeria said that keeping Malama Zinat in Kaduna prison without hospitalization has violated the known guidelines and protocols for the prevention of the spread of COVID-19.
The task force for the COVID-19 pandemic, they went around, even sharing, distributing contacts, that whenever you see somebody affected, you should call them, they will come and immediately evacuate such a person for treatment. But that of Mala Mazina, she's there for 7 days. Till today, she's still in the prison custody.
In December 2015, security forces attacked Zazaki's house and worship center, killing over 340 of his supporters and 3 of his biological children. The Islamic movement in Nigeria said it will continue to demand justice for Sheikh Zazaki and his wife.
We call on the masses to join us in calling for justice. We call on the relevant authorities to respect the law of the land and immediately and unconditionally release the corpus, as courts has ordered for their immediate release.
Zazaki's son, Muhammad, said up to now his mother, Zinat, is still in Kaduna prison and is yet to be hospitalized. The Islamic movement in Nigeria and Zazaki's son are both calling on the authorities to ensure that she receives proper medical care and to release Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki and his wife with immediate effect. Danjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
Travel agents in 13 different countries should get ready for a rush of customers. The United States has finally lifted its shockingly xenophobic and unprecedented travel ban. Iran was one of 6 other Muslim-majority nations which were primarily targeted, which caused ex-President Donald Trump's executive order to become called the Muslim travel ban, informally and infamously. New President Joe Biden ended the ban on his first day in office. The bigotry lasted 4 years, and the damage to American citizens, countless non-Americans, and America's image cannot be overestimated.
The real shame in this is not simply turning our back on, America's tradition of not judging people on the basis of their religion or our constitutional prohibition against that. But what's really, troubling about this is that we have gone through this process where family members have not been able to be together with loved ones.
Husbands and wives have been kept apart for years. Grandparents passed away without seeing their newborn grandchildren. Weddings, graduations, birthdays, funerals, jobs, business deals, educational exchanges. The accumulation of grief and difficulty caused by the Islamophobic ban is appalling. In many ways, the ban backfired, because it emphatically demonstrated the scope and reach of state-sponsored Islamophobia, something which had been routinely denied by the right and the left not only in the United States, but across the West.
It's really going to require that we go through the hard work of actually implementing policies, not just in travel, but in other ways that fight against Islamophobia, because we know that it has been a feature in our society, certainly for the last 30 years, but even long before that.
The ban led to doctor shortages in a United States which would soon be unable to handle the coronavirus pandemic. It also put a pause on the so-called brain drain, which allows America to stay near the forefront of science and technology. Trump's dehumanizing of Muslims followed years of scapegoating in order to rationalize the wars across the Muslim world started by Trump's predecessors, George W. Bush and Barack Obama. Perhaps above all, the ban showed that in the American system, it is still possible to codify racism into law. The Supreme Court reversed a series of lower court decisions which allowed the ban to go into effect. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Slim hopes of progress towards peace in Yemen were swiftly dashed this month as former US President Donald Trump designated Yemen's Houthi Ansarullah movement as a foreign terrorist organization before he left office. A move widely condemned as deeply damaging to the peace process and pushing the country towards a possible new famine. Amid fears for Yemen's future, I secured an exclusive interview with the foreign minister of the Ansarullah-led government in Sana'a for a response to these disturbing developments.
The U.S. is not an international organization or some kind of an institution that has the right to designate someone as terrorist or not terrorist. The U.S. should always be concerned about its affairs, not trying to be the guardian of the whole world.
The foreign minister explained that he felt the U.S. decision was silly and that Trump was probably paid into making the choice.
I think the Trump administration decision was something paid for, and you will see it in the near future. It's something paid for to say certain things or to take some actions. So again, from our side, we are not concerned about that, and we will not deal with it.
I asked the foreign minister whether Yemen would consider a military response. He warned that if the peace process totally fails, Yemen is strong enough to fight back.
If such peace fails, we are ready for all circumstances, and our choices are wide open. And by the way, we can affect and do what we want. We are so strong to the point that we can change the whole scenario, but we will not do it for the sake of the Yemeni people.
The foreign minister also sent a message to the new U.S. President Joe Biden.
If Biden has the courage, and I think he does, they should make an announcement that this war is over. They stop the support of the Saudis and the Emiratis and any other people involved, and the war will stop. And Mr. Biden, maybe later on, will get the Nobel Prize that Trump was running after. Now Biden should run after it.
It's been reported that Biden's foreign policy team disagrees with the terror designation and that many of Trump's policies will be reversed in quick succession. But even if the U.S. ends its support for the Saudi coalition's aggression, peace may be unachievable so long as the Ansarullah-held areas are sanctioned. Robert Carter, London.
French President Emmanuel Macron has ruled out issuing an official apology for the atrocities committed by French troops in Algeria. In a statement, Macron's office said there will be no repentance or apologies for the occupation of Algeria or the deadly eight-year war that ended 132 years of French rule in the North African country. Algeria has been demanding a formal apology for years for France's colonial-era war crimes. The French presidency, however, said France will instead endeavor to face up to its history. The statement comes ahead of the publication of a major government commission report on how France has dealt with its colonial past in the North African country. The report offers proposals to address long-standing grievances, but it skirts the issue of systematic torture by French troops and does not recommend an official apology. France occupied Algeria in 1830. The African country gained independence following the Algerian War of 1954 to 1962. The war is also known as the Algerian Revolution. Algerian historians put the death toll at 1.5 million Algerian victims, while the French historians say around 400,000 people from both sides were killed in the conflict. The truth of the colonization and the War of Independence lay buried for decades. During his presidential campaign in 2017, Macron called the colonization of Algeria a crime against humanity. In September 2018, he officially acknowledged for the first time the widespread use of torture by French forces in the former colony. However, like his predecessors, Macron has so far refrained from issuing a formal apology for his country's colonial past. But grievances tied to the colonial history have weighed on French national integration, since many French citizens are Muslims of Algerian descent. As former Foreign Minister Bernard Kouchner admitted in 2008, there seems to be a permanent contradiction between human rights and the foreign policy of France. The country's dark history of human rights violations and supporting dictators, especially in Africa and West Asia, serves as proof of Kouchner's remark that the French foreign policy is not based on human rights. France's support for former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein during his invasion of Iran in the 1980s, its support for Libya's longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi before his ouster in 2011, and the country's arms sales to Saudi Arabia while the kingdom is involved in the brutal war on Yemen are all indicative of such a policy. It so appears that human rights is only a weapon in the hands of French politicians to target nations that do not get along with their policies.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
ایستگاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything? Good morning, Mom.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of In the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. A new U.S. administration has come to power, but accusations against Washington seem to be quite familiar. Again, the U.S. is being accused of interfering in a sovereign country. This time it is Russia, where some demonstrations have taken place protesting the arrest of opposition figure Alexei Navalny on his return from Germany. Moscow has pointed the finger at Washington and trying to fuel the flames of protests in Russia. This coming at a time that Moscow says it is ready to talk to the Biden administration about improving ties. Well, stay with us as we take a look at all of this on this debate. We're going to start it off in Moscow and talk to our correspondent on the ground there, Marina Kortanova. Marina, great to have you with us. Well, fill us in on this latest situation and the accusations by Moscow of U.S. interference.
Thousands in major cities of Russia yesterday joined protest in support not only of jailed opposition figure Alexei Navalny, but against impoverishment of the population in the country, lack of production and unemployment, disagreeing with the policy of the current authorities and against the irremovability of the latter, as well as inflation, failed youth and social policy. Some scuffles and detentions took place. As you know, Alexei Navalny is a Russian opposition leader who heads the Anti-Corruption Foundation. He films investigations. Two of the latter caused the greatest resonance in Russian society. Meanwhile, the day earlier, the U.S. Embassy Moscow posted detailed information on its website regarding the time and locations of the mass rallies. Russian presidential spokesman Dmitry Peskov has described these statements as interference in the country's domestic affairs. The U.S. Embassy claimed to monitor the protests across Russia and accused the Russian authorities of suppressing free speech and free assembly. Peskov said that it is hard to imagine if Russian embassy had reacted in such manner when the United States experienced civil unrest. Then it would have caused certain discomfort in Washington. He also said that he always feels like recommending counterparts to imagine themselves in such a situation. Earlier, Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs made a statement that such comprehensive information goes beyond the concern about the well-being of U.S. citizens in Russia and goes in line with Washington's provocative and dogmatic policy of encouraging protests in countries whose governments are seen by the United States as undesirable.
Okay.
Any attempt to provide such coverage regarding unauthorized rallies to be deemed as blatant interference in Russia's country's domestic affairs and will provoke an appropriate response.
Okay, Marina, good. Marina, thanks so much for that update on the situation. That's our correspondent in Moscow, Marina Kortanova. I'd like to welcome my first guest to the program, Don DeBar, activist and commentator out of New York. Don, always a pleasure to have you on. Well, Don, it just sounds like copy-paste. I mean, it seems like we've been there before. Your take on all of this and the possibility of U.S. Stirring up the flames there now in Russia.
Well, first of all, thank you, Marcy. It's a pleasure to be here with you. You know, the Russians with this Novichok poison, if they wanted to do it right, they should come to the United States. You know, we have Monsanto. They never miss when you want to poison someone. They poison millions at a time. This is the first weekend after the new administration. For 4 years, I've been trying to point out to people and others as well that when we left off on January 19th, 2017, when the Obama administration left off, was with Russia surrounded by U.S. forces from the Baltics to the Korean Peninsula under constant war games, diplomats being expelled, you know, by the handful, rhetoric that's started in mid, I would say, in 2014, and then in July of 2016 during the campaign, really aggressive, calling Russia every kind of evil and accusing it of attempting essentially to overthrow the government of the United States, which it was claimed by such as Clapper and others, head of CIA, DNI, FBI, that actually had occurred with Donald Trump, that Donald Trump was placed in office on January 20th, 2017 by Vladimir Putin, and that he was his puppet. We heard accusations on the editorial page of the New York Times when Trump met with Putin and didn't punch him in the face. That this was treason, he should be removed and tried, and you know, there's death penalty for treason. So the first weekend after Biden takes office under this cloud, we have an uprising, quote unquote, of several thousand in Moscow, St. Petersburg, and a couple of smaller cities across Russia, coordinated, widely publicized, advance warning, by the way, from the State Department to Americans traveling in Russia that this was going to happen. But the maximum expression of what looks like the beginning of an attempted color revolution in Russia by the United States. That happening on the first day of the Biden administration, when we were concerned that they might get aggressive with Russia and even stumble into a war, is frightening, to use the simple word.
All right. Well, let me welcome My next guest, out of London, Jonathan Fryer, author and broadcaster. Thanks so much for being with us, Jonathan. Well, you heard Don kick off the program and say basically we've picked up, it seems, from where the U.S. left off 4 years ago in dealing with Russia. Your take on all this, I mean, it appears very reminiscent of 2014 Ukraine, when the U.S. was exposed for its involvement in protests, and even American officials participated in demonstrations there, cursed the EU for not being on the same page. Your take on this, and why does it seem that Washington uses the same playbook time and time again in different countries?
Well, I tend to feel that it's actually a coincidence that this has happened at the first week of the Biden presidency. We have to remember that it was triggered by Alexei Navalny's return to Russia a few days ago, and then his arrest, and then the demonstrations that have taken place across Russia. I don't think this is an American-inspired counter-protest or color revolution, as Don put it. Mm-hmm. I think that, frankly, it's quite normal for the Americans to put out a release, as they did to their citizens, to say, avoid these places. There are going to be demonstrations. There will probably be arrests, as indeed there were, well over 1,000 people picked up for what was described as an unauthorized protest. But I think actually the climate for U.S.-Russian relations is actually got a boost by the arrival of Biden, who's a much more level-headed figure than Donald Trump ever was. And indeed, the Russians themselves have just over the last 48 hours or so congratulated Joe Biden for suggesting prolonging the nuclear arms treaty for another 5 years and agreed that that would be a jolly good thing to do.
Well, what about that, Don? Because on the one hand, of course, we saw Trump or the Trump administration do some definitely off-the-wall things. But on the other hand, Trump continually wanted to have good relations with Moscow. But as you said, you pointed out that from the very beginning, he was told that the Russians had tried to interfere in the elections and that he was a spy. It just seemed to be this pull in not allowing that administration to establish closer ties. How do you see it?
First, behavior has in the context of votes in Congress. The first being the vote on sanctions, that sanctions bill that was proposed by Congress on its own initiative, adding sanctions against Russia, against Korea, and against Iran to the pile that had already existed, almost directly in response to Trump's pronouncements about Russia, that it would be good if the U.S. and Russia had better relations and not a bad thing. His actual movement towards relations and his visit ultimately to North Korea, and his failure to act on the aggressive rhetoric that he had tossed at Iran up to that point by passing a sanctions bill on the order of 517-6 or something, which is not only veto-proof but practically unanimous. That first vote telegraphed what policy was going to be, and the second one was the vote on his impeachment, which, you know, passed the House and was close enough in the Senate to be discouraging. He was looking at his foreign policy essentially being at the sufferance of Congress and his removal being an immediate tool that they would have available. And you can look at the speed by which that Ukrainian pause for his ultimate impeachment matured from the occurrence until the actual vote as you know, an indication of how tight a leash he was on. So on the one hand, even though the U.S. Continued to either allow nuclear treaties with Russia to expire and even further abrogated some or withdrew from some, a lot of the content that was actually happening around those had to do with obsolete treaties. For example, treaty that dealt with cruise missiles was critical in the 1980s, but the technology is obsolete. Now, you can have that treaty in place and still have 9 minutes or so from launch to demolition in Russia or the United States with the weapons that have been developed since. Trump's behavior was that he shut down the war games. That all by itself dropped the level of readiness of troops on both sides and the risk of accidental war, which is where I see the real risk of nuclear war coming, being accidental, but a consequence of, complete total criminal negligence on the part of the United States by forcing a level of hostilities where everything on air trigger.
Well, Jonathan, you said that you just thought that all of this is the timing was accidental. I mean, we look at Navalny's return to Russia. This is after accusing the government of being behind his poisoning. Do you not find it curious that he would return and that he would return at this time? And then we see these protests sprouting up in various cities?
No, I think it was a reasonable time to go back for him once he had recovered fully from the poisoning that he and the treatment that he underwent in Germany. So I don't find the timing strange for him to go back to Moscow at this stage. What is really interesting, though, is that whereas Alexei Navalny was very much a fringe figure a few years ago and not all that many people would support him, that situation has obviously changed. Because even though, obviously, Vladimir Putin decided that Navalny should not be allowed to contest the presidential election, nonetheless, Navalny has obviously got several thousand supporters. One can't accurately judge how many who've gone out knowing full well that if they did go out in an unauthorized protest, as they're called, they would be likely to get arrested, including his wife, of course, Yulia. So I don't think it's as sinister or as worrying as really one should feel. And I was encouraged by the fact that the Kremlin actually did say, having reprimanded the American embassy for putting out the detail of the route of one of the protests in Moscow, the Kremlin then did say what they hoped was that there would be new talks with Washington and that the way to solve problems is through negotiation. And that I absolutely endorse.
Well, let's talk about that, Don, actually, what Jonathan has just said, that in the middle of all of this and seeing these demonstrations basically increase and feeling that the United States is behind him, at the same time, Russian officials have said that they would welcome talks with the Biden administration. Your assessment of that?
First of all, just things in context. If there were kind of media support of the protests that took place in, well, let's even back up. Let's go to the period, say, from December 12th until January 6th, just prior to when the Electoral College met, up until the time that the joint session of Congress took place and the so-called attempted coup, when the guy with the horns and 100 of his friends stormed the Capitol with flags and urine and balloons or whatever else they had. If there were analogous support for that from Russian media to the American audience, to that which has been beamed at the Russian audience in support of Navalny through this entire episode, and any other opposition figure that could be found, you would have a tremendous outcry from the U.S. government that this was constituted, someone like the senator from New Hampshire, for example, that this constitutes an act of war, Gene Shinin. The scale of activity in the United States that provokes another Patriot Act, essentially. 100 people storm the gates of the Capitol and do nothing, other than get shot. One of them beats a cop to death. But, this is something that is blown out of proportion, as if you know, we were under threat of being taken over by a foreign power. Meanwhile, the support that's given to this, there are parades on behalf of the Communist Party, which gets a third of the vote in every election in Russia, that never make the air in the United States, let alone make Russian air via U.S. media. This is the context for it. What's going on is an attempt by U.S. intelligence agencies to pressure the Russian government with the threat of a color revolution. That's how it's seen in Russia, although the threat is not seen as much as Langley would like it to be, because Navalny really is still a fringe character, and that whatever he represents still has essentially a fringe following. But the attempt has already been made, and the first shot fired over the bow that, okay, this is a new sheriff in town, and we're coming in for the things we want.
Okay.
It's already been told what they want: the oil, they want the gas, they want the no competition on the global stage, and this is the first step. And they've already said more of this next week and the week after.
Well, Jonathan, in your perspective, how likely are we to see warmer relations between the U.S. and Russia now during this Biden administration?
I think we can be cautiously optimistic. I don't think we're going to see a great love-in between Washington and Moscow, but I do think the general tenor of Joe Biden's administration, assuming that it's going to be confirmed by the Senate, will be to have friendly relations with Russia, with some other countries around the world that are important in the world economy, and of course with the European Union in particular, which is a slight divergence from Donald Trump's priorities. I think also that we're seeing that Joe Biden very much wants to get away from this idea of America being isolated, being in difficult arrangements with other countries that are not suitable, not conducive to peace. And I'm cautiously optimistic, but I don't think we should go over the top on this. I don't think we should say that we're ushering in a great new era of friendship. I think it's looking good.
Well, even if you, just staying with you, Jonathan, when we look at some of the remarks actually that Don made, and referring to the last administration of Obama, and he said it feels as if we've picked up from where we had left off. Your assessment of that, because if we look at the Democrats in general, what we saw and reaction by the Democrats and others towards Trump and saying that he wanted warmer relations with Moscow, it appears that the Democrats are actually the ones that have been against the warming of this relationship. And if we look at some of the individuals who are going to be serving in the cabinet, whether we're talking about Nuland or others, not a great track record when it comes to Russian affairs.
Well, certainly several of the people who are proposed for the new cabinet are indeed familiar faces from before Donald Trump's time. And of course, Biden was vice president to President Obama, so we maybe shouldn't be surprised by that continuity. So in that sense, yes, we've gone back to a certain period where of people who have the experience of those years. But I do think that nonetheless, the world atmosphere has changed over the last 4 years, and that although Donald Trump said that he wished to improve relations with Moscow, and that he said that he was going to get a nuclear deal with North Korea, which he didn't despite his high-profile summits, I think we have a recognized situation now where we'll go back to more of a world order in which there are more balanced decisions being taken. And I don't think that Joe Biden himself will want to say anything or do anything that would antagonize Moscow at the moment. We all accept Vladimir Putin is there, and so long as he wants to be there, he's going to remain there, so that it would be ridiculous for any outside power, including the United States, to try to urge people to get rid of him, because they won't. He still has an enormous amount of support.
Okay. Well, Don, can the U.S. in your perspective, establish mutual relations with countries and treat them as equals? Is this possible in your perspective?
I mean, it's always possible. Is it possible with the current leadership? I don't know. We have to look at the context under which this administration comes to power, and how the other one was driven from power. And the primary disagreement between those factions of whatever power elite exists here that was involved in it is over two different worldviews. One that Trump saw more as a multilateral view, where the players all have their own agency, and they're expected to pay their own way, too, by the way. You know, the disagreement, quote-unquote, with the European countries, for example, was actually a disagreement with that part of the European elites that have the Atlanticist point of view, the international view, with the U.S. as a global hegemon and everyone having a respective place as a higher or lower level vassal. The view that Trump had was one more of multilateral, and the view that was in power for a long time since World War II, particularly since 1991, the fall of the USSR, was the hegemonic one. The hegemonic one is now back in power. Where does that leave Russia? It leaves Russia to do what it's told, shut up and sit down, or else. It's like the rest of the world. And unfortunately, I think Russia made a decision a long time ago, certainly since it got control of itself again when Putin came into office, that the last time they were going to allow that to happen was with Operation Barbarossa, that they weren't going to allow anyone to come in and kill 20 or 30 or 40 million Russians again without taking a lot of people out at the head end. And so as they push more aggressively against Russia, and again, I'll remind that what they were doing essentially...
20 seconds, Don.
Wargaming from the Baltics to Korea. Wargame means you start an invasion and stop at the border. The other country has to put its defenses in motion. Well, if you do that and the other country thinks you're coming in and both sides have nuclear war, I don't know another scenario for the end of humanity, but that seems to be about as close as we've mustered so far.
Okay. An unfortunate note to end, but we're out of time. I appreciate both of you being with us. Don DeBar, activist and commentator out of New York, and out of London, Jonathan Fryer, author and broadcaster. And thank you so much for being with us on Another Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
The Biden administration's first steps have already disappointed housing and racial justice activists who say bold action is urgently needed to keep people in their homes amid a deepening housing crisis, says Mike Ludwig, reporter, in an article published under the heading, Biden has extended eviction moratorium. Now it's time for more. Stay tuned for the details, please. The Biden administration's first steps have already disappointed housing and racial justice activists who say bold action is urgently needed to keep people in their homes amid a deepening housing crisis. Under Biden's direction, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, extended a moratorium on evictions through March 31st. The moratorium may prevent a mass eviction crisis in the infancy of Biden's presidency as Congress debates fair action, but the existing moratorium put in place by the Trump administration has failed to uniformly prevent landlords from pushing low-income families out of their homes during a deadly pandemic. In statements and interviews, tenant organizers and advocates for low-income renters said they are still fighting eviction processings in a number of states despite the CDC moratorium. Families are still being pushed into crowded shelters and onto the streets. Landlords in just five states filed for 4,901 evictions last week, according to Princeton University Eviction Lab, which has counted more than 220,000 evictions since the pandemic began, despite moratoriums enacted by cities and states. Extending the current CDC policy does not actually end evictions, particularly in states with weaker protections like Missouri and Kentucky, said Tara Ravenver, director of the Housing Guarantee Campaign at People's Action, in an email. Biden's decision means that courts around the U.S. will continue to hear evictions and force tenants to the streets while the pandemic rages on. Many Black, Latinx, and indigenous communities faced the housing crisis long before the pandemic began. Structural racism has generated stark racial inequalities in the housing system for centuries, and people of color are overrepresented among the estimated 14 million people who are currently behind on rent as unemployment remains rampant. Evictions and housing inequality are linked to increased spread of COVID-19 and higher rates of infection and health among Black, Latinx, and Indigenous people, according to a study published in November. For weeks, housing and racial justice activists warned the incoming Biden administration that the CDC moratorium is broken in part because it does not prevent landlords from filing for evictions in local courts. The Trump administration left the moratorium intentionally weak, with no real mechanisms for enforcement, allowing landlords to exploit loopholes and leaving millions of renters unprotected, according to the Right to the City Alliance. As Biden's transition team prepared for Inauguration Day, a coalition of groups released a letter with a list of specific fixes that would strengthen the moratorium, which currently places the burden on tenants to apply for protection under the moratorium in court. In many cases, families staring down a crisis do not know the moratorium exists. The coalition called on Biden to strengthen the moratorium by executive order. Yet the flurry of orders released by the White House since Biden took office does not include any specific on housing and evictions. It would have been easy to improve the failed Trump moratorium, and Biden should have done so, Ravenveer said, choosing not to welcome at the cost of human life. Biden does have some proposals for addressing racial housing disparities over the longer term, and his administration quickly extended a moratorium on evictions and foreclosures of rural homes enrolled in certain federal mortgage programs. The administration will also continue a pause on federal student loan collections, but many activists note the administration could have taken much stronger action toward actually canceling debt. Another executive order asks federal agencies to remove barriers to benefit, such as unemployment benefits and nutrition assistance, a policy no-brainer for Democrats replacing a Republican administration. Biden's first moves are all administrative actions the White House was able to take quickly. By extending the CDC eviction moratorium for only 2 months and without the stronger provisions, Biden signaled that he is leaving the job of protecting renters for the remainder of the pandemic up to Congress. Biden is asking Congress to pass $1.9 trillion rescue stimulus package that would extend the eviction and foreclosure moratorium through September. Along with new unemployment benefits, the package would provide $25 billion in emergency assistance for struggling renters on top of $25 billion Congress approved last month. With millions of people owing an estimated $70 billion in back rent as of last month, advocates for low-income renters say up to $100 billion is needed. While the proposal would funnel another $5 billion through assistance programs that help low-income households pay energy and water bills, it does not include a national moratorium on utility shutoffs, as some had hoped. Utilities make homes livable, but only 17 states currently require utility companies to continue providing service during the pandemic, regardless of a customer's ability to pay. Biden is also asking Congress to fund his administration's sweeping plans for speeding up the delivery of COVID vaccines and streamlining the government's pandemic response. The rescue package includes some long-time progressive priorities, such as raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. However, raising the minimum wage will likely be opposed by conservative lawmakers and millions of people struggling to pay for basics such as food and rent will not magically see their debt to landlords and bill collectors disappear when the pandemic subsides. Housing justice activists have bigger ideas for addressing the housing crisis, which they see as crucial for protecting people from COVID and addressing rampant racial inequality, two of the Biden administration's stated goals. Backed by activist Representative Ilhan Omar has pushed the Rent and Mortgage Cancellation Act, which would cancel rent and mortgage payments for the duration of the pandemic and allow landlords to recoup their losses by applying with a federal relief fund. Some activists prefer rent cancellation to direct rent relief payments because undocumented renters and others may be unable to apply for relief from the government. Housing justice activists are also demanding non-congregate housing for everyone currently living in shelters, jails, prisons, group homes, and nursing homes where social distancing is difficult or impossible. They see emergency pandemic housing as a step towards a homes guarantee that would finally eradicate homelessness by providing public eco-friendly housing. Caldwell and others who have faced eviction have embraced proposals to reinvest in existing public housing and build 12 million new homes to provide a social housing option below market rental rates. Public housing is not new, but activists say the existing system is plagued by austerity and the same systematic racism that causes widespread housing inequality to begin with. Meaningful federal investment in a homes guarantee would spare construction of energy-efficient homes across the U.S., creating badly needed jobs in green construction, according to the Justice Collaborative. We need to transform housing from commodity to public good, Caldwell said. This is not a time for incrementalism. This is a time for systematic overhaul, he said.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.